This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and thank you so much for starting off your day with us here on The Morning Run. I am Tan Chung Han and with me, Julian Ng. Good morning, Julian.
Good morning.
All right, great to have you here in the studios. And folks, you can be part of this conversation all morning long. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. Or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, we are headed into the final weekend of 2018. I don't know about you, Julian, but feels like as I get older, time goes by a lot faster. Is that the case? Because you're older than me. You've got more.
Thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, you've got the experience. So,
according to quantum physics theory, my time is running a lot more faster than yours.
There we go. Yeah. And it feels that way as well. You know?
It does feel that way. I mean, like, it's the end of the year already, and it just happened in the wink of an eye.
Exactly. So, let's make every day count. Again, you can be part of this conversation as we count down the days to 2019. All right, but first, let's give people a heads up about what's coming up for the rest of this hour. Now, we're going to consider the amount of subjects being mooted as new additions to the formal education curriculum. So, it looks like, according to an activist, the time is ripe for environmental education to be a school subject. Question is, how much is too much for the kids?
Yep, adding to the kind of homework that they do at home. We're also going to cover how far in advance should a succession plan be drawn out, especially for a new prime minister. Say you already know your prime minister for 2019 or 2020.
Mm-hmm. And in keeping with this countdown theme, in just a bit, we'll also look at some of the highlights in science and pop culture for this year. So if you've got anything that stands out in your mind, you let us know. 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Stay tuned. This is The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Steely Dan there with Do It Again. You are tuned in to The Morning Run, and thank you so much for sticking with us, Han and Julian here. Now, as we close out 2018, now we have been trying to find those highlights, right? Do some retrospective, contemplation, you know, inward looking, all that good stuff, right? And we came across this story on Vox.com with the headline that reads, 10 science stories in 2018 that made us go, whoa, that's awesome. So we've gone through this 10 science stories and we're going to go with, you know, maybe Julian's top three and then I'll go with my top three.
All okay. Right,
Julian, you kick it off.
Let me start and then I'll throw the ball back to you.
Yeah.
The first one is actually this whole phenomenon surrounding the kilogram, which was conceptualized in the 1800s in France, I think. And the measurement is certain dimensions of platinum and iridium, but that is very unstable because apparently it has been decaying. So it's not a stable measurement. And all this has to do with science, right? Because you need to have a very reliable, constant measurement weight system.
That's right.
And therefore, what they've discovered is this thing called a Planck constant, which I don't understand. So I wouldn't pretend to even go there. But really, the article highlighted the Earth, the weight of the entire Earth. You know, our Earth is 550 gigatons.
Yeah, I think I contribute a significant portion to that. Yeah, but go on.
Yeah, but a gigaton is equal to a billion metric tons, and a metric ton is 1,000 kilograms or about 2,200 pounds. I doubt, like, you are. In fact, humans are a very insignificant portion of that gigaton, less than a few percentage points of the whole weight of the Earth. So, we're going to, by May 2019, going to have a very stable kilogram so that science can go on. And you, Han, will still be a constant weight by that time, right?
Well, so there we go, right? Because you think that everything in science is measurable and kind of locked, right, in terms of its data. But then now when you've got this revising of what a kilogram actually means, and it kind of blurs that notion, right? You think everything is just so not finite, but you know, it's like infallible, like it just set in stone. And then, yeah, you have this changing or this updating of what we think to be a fundamental truth in life. Yeah, it kind of blows my mind quite a bit.
Yeah, and it's interesting to kind of find out how measurements like 1 foot or 1 pound came about, right? I'm sure in those days it was very unreliable, right? Your foot will be maybe bigger or smaller than mine,
right.
And therefore we wouldn't get the correct measurement for, say, like making a pair of pants or something. I'm sure they in the medieval times they didn't have those problems.
Yeah, well, with my ever expanding waistline, yeah, that's a constantly changing equation there. Okay, so that's one. I'm gonna go with this story here about the cave rescue. Now, that I think obviously was not just a huge scientific feat, and it certainly also tugged at the heartstrings of, you know, many of us who covered this story, right, in late June. And I recall those heavy monsoon rains that flooded the cave in northern Thailand and trapped those 12 young football players and their coach. And long story short, you know, they were all rescued, right? But this came after a 2-week-long ordeal. So I think the technological advancements that I'm not saying us here at BFM, but as mankind, right?
Definitely not
that, yeah, that we have actually achieved to be able to pull off such a brilliant rescue plan, I think, again, is testament to the ingenuity of the human race.
Yeah, I think what stood out there was in that story was the use of antidepressants like Valium and the other drug, just to keep the kids calm in a very extremely dark place that you could die in, right? And it worked because they survived that. But the other one that I liked is that NASA is now trying to reach the sun, to touch the sun.
What?
Because they apparently have been, very puzzled by the fact that the surface of the sun, the atmosphere of the sun is much hotter than the surface of the sun, and trying to find out why, right? The things, the kind of lengths that men go through to just satisfy your curiosity. So in a few years' time, by 2025, they would in fact come within 4 million kilometers of the sun, which at that point in time would be about 1,370 degrees Celsius.
Oh, my word.
And they would actually be, that spaceship or whatever that the device is, that would be traveling at 430,000 miles per hour.
All right, so real quick correction there. It's 4 million miles, not 4 million kilometers. I mean, look,
4 million miles, yeah. Look, sorry, we go back to the metric system. Yeah,
I was going to say, just because...
This is American.
Yeah, no, just because they revise the kg doesn't mean
exactly,
they can revise...
Exactly, like simply do the miles.
Kilometers,
right?
As well. Yeah, so look, we'll be tweeting out this story in just a bit. Again, our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio. You can leave your comments there, or if you think there's another scientific story that is or that has a much bigger wow factor than the 10 listed in this article on Fox.com, well, let us know on Twitter at BFM Radio, or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Okay, coming up in just a bit, we'll talk about the political realm and how far in advance should succession plans be drawn out. Stay tuned right here to The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was MGMT with me and Michael. This is The Morning Run, me and Julian. That's not grammatically correct, is it? Yeah, it's Julian and I here on The Morning Run. Anyways,
it's okay.
I'm just trying to play off that song title. Yeah, a terrible attempt there. Yeah, so Han and Julian here, keeping you company all the way till 10 a.m. this morning. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation. WhatsApp us 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Let's talk politics, or really the concept of democracy, and really perhaps which model is better. Well, specifically in terms of its succession plan, because I'm looking at these couple of articles here, one on The Economist and another on criticalspectator.com, essentially debating the merits of having a succession plan a la Singapore, actually to some extent even here in Malaysia, right, whereby the next prime minister has been appointed. So for in Singapore's case, come 2022, 2022, it'll be Heng Swee Keat taking over from Lee Hsien Loong. And then here in Malaysia, theoretically speaking, come 2020, it'll be Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim taking over from Tun Dr. Mahathir. Now, whether or not these succession plans are perhaps undemocratic in nature?
Yeah, actually, this article from Critical Spectator sort of pans The Economist article, which paints Singapore as a very meritocratic, technocratic, and even engineered their own political landscape, right? Mm. So The Economist doesn't like that. I think there are pros and cons. For example, the authoritarian state of China has lifted hundreds of millions out of poverty. Could they have done that without the authoritarianism? But on the other hand, so argues the article, democracy has given you things like Donald Trump and the phenomenon of Brexit, which isn't exactly very palatable to those nations. So I'm on one side of the argument. Before I tell you what my side is, Han, I'm just curious what you think of this.
Yeah, look, I think this is a fascinating debate, right? Because on one hand, it evokes issues like policy continuity, right? Political stability in the country, and from an investor's point of view, and that's one of a plethora of lenses that you can use to view this political phenomenon, is that that those components are important. Again, policy continuity and political stability here. But then at the same time, does it mean that these things are mutually exclusive to human rights, the development of mankind? I don't think so. And or the liberalizing of minds, I don't think so. I think they both can happen in tandem, but obviously, I'd be naive to not say that there's bound to be some dilution on that front.
And the article also raises the difference between, or a kind of perceived difference between the so-called Asian culture and the Western culture, which I think many times is just an excuse for not having more democracy, right? Mm. So I'm putting my neck on the line here, and I say I disagree with that. I kind of agree with economists saying that we need more critical analysis of our leaders and our political situation. We need to have them fight it out rather than have an engineered situation. We need to forget about this whole confusion idea, which is again the excuse that a lot of the Asian leaders bring to us, because at the very bottom level, the B40 and M40, they need more rights, I think.
Yeah, look, and I've said this many, many times on the program before, I'm one who uses the bottom-up approach, right? So I'm all for the grassroots leaders, the sentiment at the grassroots level then being reflected at the top levels of leadership. I guess to use a cliche, it's often the leaders that we get are really reflective of, I think, are the leaders we deserve. I think that's the saying there,
yeah.
Right? So I subscribe to that notion. However, just looking at what's happening on a global stage, that with the rise of populism across Europe, etc., I think it is a pushback, or it's certainly a dent in the Western brand of democracy, right? So I think moving forward, the whole world, not just Asian and Western economies, and drawing this distinct line between the two, I think every country will then have to move forward with their own brand of democracy. And I think we are at these crossroads right now. We have to figure out what it really is. Now, this is a timely discussion because next year, you've got elections in Thailand, in Indonesia, right? And several other countries around the region as well. So, could we see a new brand of democracy come out of ASEAN? Because here in Malaysia, we already had that momentous decision that happened on May 9th, right? Could that have repercussions across the region, at least when it comes to how we define democracy? Pretty timely discussion as we go into 2019. Let us know what you think. 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We are coming up to the 6:30 a.m. news bulletin, and taking us there is Portishead with Wandering Star here on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was OK Go with This Too Shall Pass. I love the band OK Go there. If you're not familiar with them, be sure to check out their music videos. I'm Tan Cheng Han, with me Julian Ng. This is The Morning Run, and 2018 Too Shall Pass. And, you know, looking ahead to, you know, upcoming years, there's talk about perhaps adding new subjects to the formal education system. According to an activist, that's the president of the Malaysian Nature Society, the time is ripe for environmental education to be a formal school subject. Now, while broadly speaking, I think a greater level of awareness, of environmental awareness, is sorely needed in Malaysian society. But one has to ask whether or not the schools, the formal education setting, is the best setting for such a lesson.
Yep. Ignoring aside for the moment how you would train teachers to broach this subject to the students, because I think the environment could be quite a complicated subject, right? Things may not seem as they are. For example, you know, cows giving out methane, and should you stop eating cows, right? Those are kind of questions that are very complicated.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good start to raise awareness. And Han, I think earlier on when we were chatting, you also had the point that mindsets can't be changed so easily, right? Especially whether schools can be a point where you change mindsets.
Right, because, you know, how often have we been inundated? I mean, just think back to your schooling days, right? You're just inundated with so many facts and data where it becomes purely academic. Once the test is over, and then if it's not applicable to your life, then, you know, like, little is retained, if anything at all, right? So I think the broader impact will be more sustainable, at least in terms of the green agenda, if we as a society then actually adopt these practices. So there are many ways to change behavior, to change mindsets beyond the schooling system. Now, I'm not saying that the school is doesn't play a role. It does play a role. But I think that spotlight should be broadened and to look at other agencies of socialization, as a sociologist will call it. So, for example, from the family setting to how society operates, you know, even how how corporates roll out their goods and services, if they do so in a more environmentally friendly way, that could change, or that I think has a better sway, bigger sway on how people can, you know, adopt a more greener culture.
I'm always really fascinated by this need or this agenda, this motivation to change mindsets, right? Not that I am not for it. I'm just fascinated because it assumes that the people at large are ignorant, right? And it takes a holier than thou positioning. So should we just leave it to the people, or are we actually saying that the people have no ability right now to decide for themselves? And again, you mentioned a very important word, which is agenda, right? Whose agenda are we on right now? We are on the Greens' agendas, or are we on somebody else's agenda? For example, this smoking issue, right? It's very controversial. Like, smokers have come out to say that...
Of smoking at eateries starting January
1st. Exactly, okay, right? Okay. They have come up to say that they have rights as well. And it's not for lack of knowledge that smoking is bad for you, but still people are coming forward with the ideas of rights. So do we leave it to the masses to decide what's good for the earth, or do we try to engineer a situation where we raise more awareness for the benefit of all?
Yeah, well, look, it depends on, how you view being the base case of human nature, right? You know, are we inherently sinful and we have taught how to be good, or vice versa? Are we inherently good and then we have along the way picked up these really nasty habits?
So, or are we just good but ignorant?
Okay, yeah.
Unenlightened.
Right, but for me, right, I think there has to be a lot of education, and this is education and agenda that's based on facts. So what we do know is that the environment is under threat, okay? Everything from pollution, not just on a micro level, but at the macro level as well. And something has to give, right? Because if we continue on this path, ignorant or otherwise, it will result in the tremendous destruction of the environment, you know, beyond what has already been destroyed. So I think some intervention is necessary. Now, is the intervention going to come via the changing of mindset in schools? I think that's a limited discussion. I think that discussion has been broadened out to how do you change behaviors and mindsets in broader society.
Yep. If not schools, then what, right? How do you actually, like, if you go back to parenting, for example, how do you actually change the mindset of a parent? Do you send the parents back to school? I think this conversation is a very long drawn one, including not only the environment, but other subjects as well.
Certainly.
Safety, health, and so on.
Yep. Well, you can be part of this long drawn out conversation. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. And we'll be tweeting out the link to this story in just a bit. So the according to the president of the Malaysian Nature Society, Professor Maktab Mohamad, he says that the time is ripe for environmental education to be a school subject. So again, I mean, this opens up so many discussion points. Does it have to be done via schools, or can other agencies of socialization impart this knowledge? Or, you know, does it require a broader change of mindset and habits in broader society? Let us know what you think. And of course, think of the kids. You know, how much more homework can they really take on? 01878-
I think it'd be more interesting in geography, I think.
Yeah. 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. This is The Morning Run. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Human League with Don't You Want Me. This is The Morning Run. Han and Julian here, keeping you company all the way till 10 a.m. this morning. Looks like users of Netflix did not want their community strategy. And I don't have Netflix. Julian, do you have Netflix?
You don't have Netflix?
I know.
Come on, what's going on?
I don't have time for that, man.
Wow.
I have two jobs.
What do you do with your time?
I have two jobs.
No, you got to make time for it.
I know.
Okay, anyways.
So you as a Netflix proponent there, apparently there was this community strategy, kind of like a social networking element to it that essentially failed, right? And there's this story on Medium.com about the lessons that we can learn from this failed community strategy from Netflix.
You know what? Before we go on with this discussion, can I just say my TV is spoiled. Okay. So... I haven't had the chance to watch any TV in the last 2 weeks. It's still under extended warranty, but how crazy is that? In this day and age, you get TV spoiling. Okay. Anyway, yeah. That's a discussion for another day. Yeah. So social media, the first thing that pops into my head, social media for Netflix, it's too challenging because it's just too hard to navigate the remote control and press.
Oh.
You know, whatever that needs to be pressed to share with your friends.
So right? It failed primarily because of the terrible user experience? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. Oh. I don't know why it failed, but I guess that could be one of the big reasons. People just don't care, right? They switch on their telly TV and they just want to watch the show. They you know, it's very unlike YouTube, for example, because you have that thumbs up, thumbs down button there conveniently exposed for you to press on, even on a smart device. But I haven't seen that feature on Netflix.
All right. Well, so just to give you some history here. So Netflix launched Friends, that's their social feature there, in 2004. And long story short, it failed. And it turns out that failure at Netflix isn't so uncommon. Looks like half of Netflix's high-level product strategies actually fail. So this article dives into why these things may fail, right? Essentially, two reasons. One, there are many biases that cloud human judgment. And then two, it's hard to invent the future. So as businesses and individuals, you know, try to, you know, come up with strategies that can improve their products or, you know, goods and services. But then at the down, I mean, when you consider the downside, I think it's also important to note when to pull the plug, because that notion there, when to pull the plug, that's important not just for the likes of Netflix, it's also important for you and me, right? You know, in terms of our investments or in terms of our different pursuits. So it's important to know when to draw the line in the sand and say, look, enough is enough.
Yeah, I don't know if I completely agree with this article, because I think Netflix, for all intents and purposes, is a very successful company. I mean, you just have to look at the share price trajectory over the last few years to reflect that, right? Of course, the price has fallen over the last few months, But Netflix has got bigger strategies. I mean, they've allocated about, if I'm not mistaken, $10 billion for content, right? So they've been coming out with their own original content, so which gives them the space to kind of gamble on these small projects. And if one of those small little gambles of the many ticks off, then they can pat themselves on the back and add further to their value and their branding.
Right. But I think looking specifically at this Friends strategy under Netflix, they were saying that, well, they persisted for it for too long. And some of the reasons why it went on for so long or too long was because, firstly, the CEO supported it. At the same time, there were some small wins, but that clouded their judgment on the long-term sustainability of this project. And then you also have this inherent bias to overvalue what you have in hand versus what the market might value it at. So all these different factors contributed to the ultimate failure of this Friends feature.
That's very interesting. That's the sunk cost phenomenon, right? We value, for example, stock market losses. You know, we've made like 20% loss and, oh, I can't sell that. And that's irrelevant because what you really need to do is to look at it from this point onwards, not looking past at your past losses. So that has a personal angle. Dimension to it as well.
Yeah, certainly. You know, and I think this is something, again, that we need to be reminded of, these kind of inherent biases that we may employ when judging the value of different assets or different endeavors that we're doing it. Is it really worth all the cost that you have really sunk into that particular item? And then when do you cut loss, right? So let us know what you think. 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Do you have any tips or advice or experiences when it comes to cutting losses, be they painful or a welcomed cutting of the cord, so to speak? Let us know here on The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. And it's coming up to 6 minutes past 7 a.m. on this Friday, December 28th. We are just about to enter the final weekend of 2018. I'm Tan Chung Han, with me Julian Ng, and you are tuned in to The Morning Run. Now, earlier this morning, we spoke about this proposal to add environmental education to the school syllabus. The time is ripe, according to the president of the Malaysian Nature Society, Professor Markitab Mohamed. So we've had a couple of comments coming in from you guys. Let's start with the one from Karen Wong, who says that environmental education should not have any exams. It must be fun and practical. She believes school is the right place because in their peer groups, they learn more effectively and are pressured, in air quotes there, pressured to follow. Maybe like sports, extra points can be given to earn credits. So those are the thoughts from Karen, and we've got a WhatsApp in from Ro as well.
Yep, he's wrote into say that environmental education is not just a great idea, but also long overdue. He said that he's covered thousands of kilometers on his bicycle and not come across a square foot of nature without human litter.
Look, I think broadly speaking, we agree that a heightened level of awareness for environmental education is needed. But often our first instinct is to point to the formal education system, right? And everything from, oh, kids need to learn coding. I think recently we spoke about they need to learn 3 to 4 languages. Now environmental education, more sciences, more STEM, right? And the pressures on the scarce resources dedicated to the education system just gets further strained, So you have to perhaps consider the practicalities. Well, ideally, sure, yes, from an ideal stance, more is needed. But from a practical or realist standpoint, there has to be a line drawn somewhere, because you have to consider the opportunity costs. And I guess that's where I often come from when it comes to some of these issues. But keep your comments coming in. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Moving on to another story, let's look at DBKL. The KL City Hall is allocating 2.9 billion ringgit from its budget 2019 to benefit some 1.8 million city folk, probably including many of you listening to this program right now. And let's go through the numbers here, Julian.
Yep, we see a breakdown here where 58.5% of the budget goes into operating expenditure, and that amounts to 1.7 billion ringgit. There's a 3.7% decline from last year, or a 66 million decline in operating allocation. Development Europe's expenditure has a 41.5% share, or 1.2 billion ringgit share of that budget, and this is an increase of 5%. Two positive observations here. One is that you want to favor development over operating, right? You want to reduce operational costs of running that city, and that's a 5% increase for operating. The second observation is that 41% is devoted to development, which I think is very good and very different from the national budget, of which development only gets 20% bite of the national budget. And, you know, everyone has been complaining about this from time immemorial because 80% of the national budget of almost 300 billion thereabout goes into maintaining the government.
Right.
That's too much money.
And a big chunk of it is taken up by pensions and salaries.
PM's department.
Yeah, PM's department.
Jakim and things like that.
Right. Yeah. Although there, I think, at least when it comes to the emoluments and the salaries and the pensions, there's a political cost to it as well. And we haven't seen a significant change in that under this new government, or at least a significant reduction. But speaking about reductions, going back to DBKL's budget, looks like revenue is expected to fall next year as well. Some 2.5 billion ringgit estimated in revenue for next year. And that's a drop of about 200 million ringgit compared to the year prior. Now, the main source of revenue for DBKL is the Cukai Pintu, right? The assessment collection. That contributes almost half of the entire earnings for DBKL. So now, you know, you look at headlines, for example, that came out of Knight Frank yesterday, and we mentioned this on the show yesterday, about how KL home prices fell this year. And, you know, I don't know if that trend will continue into next year. We'll see what Knight Frank says. Now, is this market correction in the property sector that some have been wanting for a while now.
Very much in line with corrections in the global markets and commodities as well, and even bitcoins,
right,
dare I say.
So how does this feed into DBKL's coffers or the lack thereof?
Yep, that's right. Cukai Pintu is almost half of their revenue. But some major allocations, 692 million went to the management and development of roads and drainage, and another 262 million ringgit to manage 33 people's housing projects and 32 public housing schemes in the city. And this covers more than 73,000 homes. Of the total, 142 million is for house repairs and maintenance, such as electrical and mechanical repairs.
Now, so beyond the ratio of development versus operating expenditure that you mentioned earlier, Julian, I think one of the key talking points out of this budget has been the allocation on public transport. Now, Julian, I know you are a fan of public transport. When I start my new job next year, I'm going to have to use public transport as well. I'm going to take that train along with you guys, the rest of you, into the heart of KL.
I love it. I love it.
So now, 20 million ringgit though, 20 million ringgit allocation to operate the free Go KL bus service. So the 20 million will go towards extending routes and also including more buses. Now, we recall a couple of months ago, there was a pushback against this idea because you've got these Go KL buses, which are free, but turns out they benefit more of the foreign population here in Malaysia versus Malaysian taxpayers themselves.
That's not their fault.
I mean, the
locals don't want to use public transportation, right? They still want to drive.
Exactly, you know. And then at the same time, you know, these foreign workers are here in Malaysia contributing to our economy as well.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I think that they should get those services as well. If you, as a taxpayer or a KL resident, even though you're paying our taxes, but you don't use the bus service, then, well, tough on you, right?
I mean, there's 65,000 passengers daily using the service. I mean, if you take this service away, where would they go, right? It would add to the congestion of the city.
Right, exactly. So, you know, and recall that the Federal Territories Minister announced that DBKL will take over the Go KL free bus service from the Transport Ministry. That starts on Tuesday, January 1st. So there's a shift in the ownership and the management of this Go KL bus service.
Also, I think it's not expensive to run a free service like that. It only costs about 20 million ringgit. And it increases as well as the budget demands expands and we get awareness of what people in KL want. The other thing, Han, is that the government is also going to launch that My 100 or My 50 monthly unlimited travels. I think that those are great ideas.
Yep. So again, I'm going to have to look into more details because I have to use public transport starting next year.
Good
on
you.
So again, it's just a one-off monthly fee, right? And then you can use all the buses and
that's
trains.
Right. Trains, rapid buses, MRT, LRTs, and even KTMs, I think. Oh. I don't know whether KTM is included in that because KTM covers longer distances.
Mm, right. Okay. And then recall how the government was talking about, you know, having Grab perhaps supplement the final mile connectivity
thing.
That
would be nice.
Yeah, I don't know how, I don't know what kind of traction it's gotten on that front. But anyways, so, you know, keep in mind, these are some of the developments there when it comes to traveling, not just in and out of KL, but also around the Klang Valley. And so for more information, I guess you can always go check out DBKL's website. All right, coming up in just a bit, we'll take a look at the front pages of the local papers, including the freeze on toll hikes across Malaysia. Stay tuned right here to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.